Thanks to all of you for being here. It was a wonderful evening. I am last night, and I'm terribly excited about the program today. Let's go ahead and get started. Many of you know Mary McClintock Fulkerson's work. It's a pleasure having you here for SILT 2011. Mary is an ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church USA and professor of theology at Duke Divinity School, where she also teaches in the Women's Studies program. How's Kathy Rudy doing, by the way? Do you ever see her around? She's doing well? Yeah. Is that right? Miss her. Anyway, her first book, Changing the Subject, Women's Discourses in Feminist Theology, examined the liberating practices of non-feminist church women and feminist academics through the lens of post-structuralism and Marxist feminist literary criticism. Her recent book, the book that's the focus of our conversation today, Places of Redemption, Theology for a Worldly Church, explores the practices of an interracial church, as you know, that includes peoples with disabilities. This project offers a theory of practices and place that foregrounds the effective reactions and communications that shape all groups, particularly around perceptions of otherness. And I read the book and followed its development over a number of years with great admiration and a sense that this book also offered a very helpful testing of certain fashionable ecclesiologies that really had never been looked at the ground level. So we can perhaps talk about that later, but I think this book does all kinds of interesting work and look forward to hearing more about this from you. Thanks.
Thanks, Charles. That's really nice. I've said this to some of you. I was at a really long conference on ecclesiology and exclusion last week, and I got so tired that I was sitting there on one side of the room, and a colleague of mine was on the other side of the room. Later on, they told me that he actually saw me doze off. So you have permission to doze off, is my point. So which part of the life of a Christian community is theological or theologically ethical? Is it the talk, the sermon, the pastoral counseling, the recital of creeds? Does theological only refer to things said in church space? Or if you're like outside and you're talking, is it theological? Is it really only about doctrine? Well, what about people who don't understand doctrine or never hear about it? What about people who live on the streets? Their major vocation is survival. Is anything theological about that? What about the color of bodies? What about the status of bodies in our culture? Does that have anything to do with theology? Unfortunately, as I've been trained, a lot of those kinds of things haven't been considered explicitly theological, possibly ethical. So in what follows, I'd like to get at indirectly those kind of questions by talking about the issues that emerge from my participant observation at Good Samaritan. First, I'm going to talk about why theologians need ethnography. Second, how ethnography opens to view the need for other frames, as Manuel's work has so wonderfully developed, other frames. Thirdly, the importance of understanding these explorations as theological inquiry and the benefits of that. Fourthly, the challenges generated by ethnographic research for many traditional modes of thinking about theological reflection. And finally, some issues I haven't resolved, and I'll give that as a handout. So first, the need for ethnography. Typically, systematics or the traditional creeds have dominated or obviously been central to what counts as theology. But of course, there have long been criticisms of this. of the theory practice model in theology. Charles Taylor, long ago, exposed the inadequacy of the causal force of rules relative to practice. David Kelsey, long ago, suggested the image of a mobile as more suggestive for theological reflection than the sort of linear foundation that leads to an interpretation of situations. Liberation theology has exposed the contextual power-laden character of any starting place, and proposed the notion of a hermeneutical spiral rather than a circle or unidirectional causal impact of a text or belief and action. A lot of these shifts, however, are primarily hermeneutical. And ethnographic study complicates these approaches. To its credit, though, liberation theology did generate the need for attention to popular faith culture, which is what shifted my focus. I don't remember liberation theologies doing ethnographic or popular culture, but that's the direction they were pointing in. So as a feminist theologian, my first book was an attempt to look at popular culture of women. And I wanted to look particularly at non-feminist women, as Charles has already said, with the lens of a feminist theologian. But I didn't want to be assessing them based on Mary Daly or Rosemary Redford Ruther. I wanted to say, okay, how do we honor their creativity as they appropriate their traditions? So as Charles said, I used post-structuralism to destabilize fixed meanings, culture theory, communication theory to flesh out the agency of poor Appalachian Pentecostal women and white middle-class Presbyterian women in their organizations. Now, a cultural anthropologist I happened to go to church with read my book because she'd done work on in Appalachia, and she recommended ethnographic study. I didn't even know about it at that point. She said it would allow for much richer sense of a community if I did participant observation. So I took a course at UNC on ethnography, and that introduced me to this kind of exploration that really did open up my theological world and continues. So I went from using post-structuralism, Marxist, feminist, culture theory to read practices as texts, that's what I was doing, to a new awareness of the need to move beyond that, as Vasquez's work makes clear. I want to return to that issue, though. But it seems with ethnographic study, the possibilities for moving outside of the textualizing of Christian faith emerge. I mean, I was still treating their practices as texts. So my first sense of this need, and if you've read the book, a lot of this is going to be repetition, happened with the discovery of that most of the members of the church did not do orthodox theological speak, and I tended to silence them when I asked them for the theological reasons or explanations for the commendable, unusual, multiracial community they'd created. What I gradually came to understand is that the criteria of orthodoxy, liberal or conservative, is not only inadequate, it is dehumanizing. If correct belief, regardless whether it's liberal or conservative, is a prerequisite for Christian faithfulness, it will exclude most of humanity. Many of whom were never even given access to, you know, the more complex levels of beliefs, many of whom couldn't understand it even if they were taught Chalcedonian creeds or et cetera, et cetera. So in short, I'd say, obviously I'm not going to do away with doctrine, et cetera, but the need for ethnography to surface the forms that lived faith takes is crucial. It's important. It's timely. It's also theological. Common sense tells us that attention to lived faith would go with being a theologian. I mean, if you're a minister, you certainly need to understand your community's faith in some fuller, fleshed-out way. And, you know, classically, before it split into a speculative science in the university, theologia, knowledge of God, always entailed formation. While there was no one use of the term theology in early Christianity, from the beginning there was an adaption of the basic ancient Greek sense that faith is a paideia, a knowledge of God, and I put knowledge in quotes because that's a spectrum, and it entailed the formation of persons' souls. Theology at its most profound has always been practical in some sense. And since formation, lived knowledge of God, necessarily requires assessment of one's situation, the parameters of faithful response, then practical entails conviction, reflection, and much more. And of course, souls is a problematic term. It's always associated, or tends to be associated, with the mind-body dichotomy. But practical theology came to mean a variety of different things, from the lived faith of believers, a curricular area, a method, to an academic discipline, to a focus on clerical practices. But its ideal use, theologia, invokes this general overarching frame or sense of reflective, formative, lived knowledge of God. And lived knowledge is precisely what ethnographic study is filling out. So, what's the point, then, of theology if it's not about or relevant to life in all its complexities? How can theology matter if it's not going to take seriously all the difference, ambiguity, beauty, horror, tragedy of created life? And while the notion of theologia continues to be relevant, classically its specifics were not fully fleshed out in my limited experience of church history. Given ancient anthropology with its patriarchal, inadequately sexual, carnal, psychological assumptions, it was inadequately fleshed out. So, contemporary theology must have some grasp of these complex, messy realities, and participant observation is a marvelous way to initiate access to them. To put this more explicitly, a theological rationale for ethnographic work is the incarnational nature of Christianity. While differently narrated over the centuries, such a defining theme as incarnation at its very minimum affirms the immanence of the divine, an immanence that requires the honoring of the finitely good creation in all its ambiguity, brokenness, and potential redemption. So, given that theology needs to attend to live faith, what kind of analysis is ethnography? Now, some worry that it's risky because it may be tainted by social sciences, or it might endanger theological thinking with the stain of the world, as opposed to being clear about the valorizing of a church take on and distinction from the world. I don't take on that debate. I do assume, though, that the very use of ethnographic inquiry is, as postmodern cultural anthropologists argue, a value-laden endeavor, and that there are no absolute distinctions between so-called Christian church takes on the world and worldly takes on lived faith. I'm saying there's no absolute distinction, and I'm saying we don't have criteria. Now, but I'll defend that later. Now, this is emerging with other theologians. Refusing blueprint theology or the imposition of forms of belief and practice that may be at odds with the living situation, theologian Nicholas Healy has argued for theological use of ethnographic accounts of communities. John referred yesterday to that What Ethnography Is Dogmatics article in the Scottish Journal of Theology. Now, there's a book that just came out this month, Ethnography as Christian Theology and Ethics. Anybody know about this book? Yes, it is. Makes this argument, but doesn't ground it in a doctrine, which is what Healy does. He grounds it in the Trinity. Ethnography is not simply a precursor to theological or ethical reflection, nor is it simply for thick description. Its very practice is theological, argue Chris, Sharon, and Anna Marie Vegan. So, they're the primary editors. They say, and I'm going to quote for them, from them for a little while, it can serve as an intervention that calls into question antagonistic Christianity, antagonistic church or theology versus world kind of thinking. Exploring worldly theology through the use of ethnography invites scholars and others to see how intertwined faith, theology, church, culture, and the larger societies are. Theology, culture, sciences, history are all in a dynamic spiral, informing, revising, reinforcing, critiquing, and responding to one another. They also, these authors, editors, present ethnography as a form of witness. They want to talk about participant witnesses, not participant observers. Now, this is developed in some respects out of POMO ethnography that acknowledges the subject position and the impact of the ethnographic person as well, but this is pushing it in a theological direction. Ethnographic witnessing on the part of both ethnographer and collaborator informant can take on a normative quality, this is vegan, in the sense that witnessing to human struggles can implicitly or explicitly carry an imperative to transform suffering into healing and well-being. I recommend the book. Now, that is an interpretation that's relatively new. It will require more debate. However, by interpreting these practices as theological, these worldly differences and all their difference are granted status as places where divine presence could be discerned and as central to real theology. What's more, the role of the theologian, his or her social location, begins to matter much more, and in ways it didn't in liberation theology, I think. So, how is the resulting account based upon participant observation, really theological? As you know, if you've read Places of Redemption, chapters 1 through 7 are descriptions, but not some kind of objective description, objective empirical description. Any and all descriptions, I think, have some degree of valuational character, whether from the explicit moral valuational judgment that X is better than Y, or something more subtle, like a judgment that this needs to be looked at, or that's been ignored. To me, that's a valuational judgment. Now, of course, non-theological approaches tend to think that theology is a completely and problematically uncritical form of valuational discourse, and Manuel gave us a great example of the way religious studies can do that. But I don't think that's complete, and I don't think that's completely fair. I mean, I really appreciate what you had to say. Unacknowledged valuational commitments are operative all over the university. I mean, I think of the secular feminist theorists, for example. They invoke value in theories that continue to complicate power, and they invoke theories because they enhance and improve an analysis of oppression and liberation. That's value-oriented. Nobody asks for an absolute proof of how it is that these are goods that are intellectual. That secular feminist doesn't have to justify those given and assumed values and goods. I don't know, maybe a social scientist would want a justification, but that's just an example. Another example, theology illustrates this blindness to values that are entailed in judgments in another way when a contrast is assumed between what is called contextual theology and the kind of theology that is unmarked, as if it came from nowhere. The real theology has unacknowledged privileging of, you know, certain kinds of subjects, a white male rational way of thinking. Anyway, so here's an example of valuational ethnography, or understanding ethnography as valuational. This is not just the POMO view that the cultural anthropologist brings her or his contextual lens and produces an ethnographic account, but this is the claim that ethnographic description itself is basically allegorical. James Clifford argued in an essay in that book, Writing Culture, which was, I think, a significant milestone in cultural anthropology, that ethnography, quote, is a performance implotted by powerful stories which simultaneously describe real cultural events and make additional moral, ideological, and even cosmological statements. Ethnographic writing is allegorical at the level of both its content, what it says about cultures, and of its form, what is implied by its mode of textualization. Recognition of allegory inescapably poses the political and ethical dimensions of ethnographic writing. So, ethnographic accounts, quote, can never be limited to a project of scientific description so long as the guiding task of the work is to make the often strange behavior of a different way of life humanly comprehensible. To say that exotic behavior and symbols make sense either in human or cultural terms is to supply the same sorts of allegorical added meanings that appear in older narratives, this is surprising, that say actions are spiritually significant. So he's making this comparison. Thus, allegory prompts us to say of any cultural description, not this represents or symbolizes that, but rather this ethnographic description is a morally charged story about that. Ethnographic accounts inevitably have, and this is his word, transcendental meanings, not that are added to some original simple account, but rather are conditions of their meaningfulness. Clifford's primary example, does anybody remember that essay? Oh, okay. Clifford's primary example is the work of Marjorie Shostak on, I don't know how to pronounce it, Nisa, a Kung woman, with an upside down, excellent. And the story of her giving birth, and he reads this as an allegorical ethnographic description done by Shostak. It evokes a distinctive cultural form of labor, but it compels because it's also registering as a common human female experience. So, given this allegorical function, what about theology and what's normative about a theological approach? Here's my version, and I didn't develop this as allegorical, but clearly with valuational attention to the church. My account of the church is articulated around particular valuations, most of which are only implicitly theological until chapter 8. I began with this explicit claim that an incarnational God would invite attention to more of this reality rather than less. Thus, my move beyond belief and my choice of theoretical lenses, like place theory, Paul Connerton's account of incorporative practice, is motivated by a theological conviction, but it's implicit. Further development of my valuational logic resonates with Kathy Tanner's observation that typically it's only disruptions or crises that generate explicit theological reflection. Normally, we all just live our lives out of deeply embedded, pre-reflective habituations, including postures of faith, not as the conscious application of doctrine or faith or rules. Now, to defend my logic in the book, I invoked Charles Winquest's claim that creative thinking is generated by a wound. Now, this could be discussed at two levels. The everyday believer, the wound, something generates the need to reflect, what do I need to do? What does God want me to do? But I'm talking at the level of, you know, the production of theology, what counts as theology. So we can understand wound in a very general way, as referring to a lot of what theologians do, whether ethnographic or not. I mean, Bonhoeffer proceeded there to be a wound that needed addressing as he saw the sellout of the German church. The perceived underrating of the divinity of Jesus might have been perceived as a wound that generated some Chalcedonian thinking. Or too long ignoring the role of bodily incarnation habituation could be perceived as a wound, and that's an aversion, and that's the way I took it. So I valued, or my valuing of this community included a kind of logic. I discerned a particular set of wounds in the community, wounds around the continuing harms perpetrated against minority populations, particularly people of color and people with disabilities. Given the clear faith commitments of the people in this church, they organized around bringing in people not like us. I could have simply blessed this and said, this is a wonderful place. Let me write about all the wonderful, faithful things these people are doing. However, there was a discernment of harm that emerged for me, despite the language of loving the neighbor and being colorblind. And I connected this to practices that fail to support a place to appear for these persons. Now, I used Hannah Arendt's phrase, place to appear, because it was a more flexible image for harm and redress than I found in a typical theological repertoire. There are probably other ways to frame that too. So, in short, my ethnographic narrative and reading of the community, which shaped the things, you know, obviously that I wrote about, but that I paid attention to, mapped out a terrain of needed and actualized transformation. I framed it as a story of obliviousness, aversiveness, and other forms of ostensibly unintentional racism and ableism that endure in forms of constructive alteration of these harms. Now, of course, the narrative was framed differently for different groups. A primary harm displayed in whites' practices was deeply embodied habituations of obliviousness, colorblindness, or aversion to black bodies, or both. And this was displayed as what I called ownership of space. For primarily African Americans, the harm that I perceived was deeply embodied habituations of hypervigilance and sometimes the experience of self-loathing. For the normate, the harm was aversiveness to certain kinds of bodies. This, again, is a valuational reading with the potential for connections with more formal reflections of faith, as in how the diminishing of fearful obliviousness and protective vigilance through enhancement of places to appear can conceivably be narrated as about the presence of God. As I said, more explicit reading of this narrative of harms and the practices which supported places to appear is developed explicitly in Chapter 8 in more explicit terms, using sin, et cetera, et cetera. There I use a theonomous anthropology and categories of idolatry and social brokenness entailed by that understanding of sin to interpret the places to appear as redemptive alterations. So, more about that later. Okay, this might be the third, I don't remember. New realities that emerge out of the use of ethnography. Now, I've already given examples of judgments I made in my narrating this, in my discernment, my valuational discernment, that caused me to find new frames. I mean, what I just described did not simply come out of the interviews with the people I did. Nobody said to me, no white person said to me, I'm deeply aversive to, there are too many black, and one of the phrases that got me going on this was the story. This had been a multiracial church intentionally, and one of the stories the white minister told me about was that some of the white people had left, if you remember this story, some of the white people had left because he was out of town. A black Liberian man preached, and some of the white guys came to the minister later and said, the church is getting too black. Now, nobody I interviewed talked to me about the church getting too black. But I needed other frames to flesh out something that would help me get at what this could be about, since it wasn't about belief. Anyway, so other examples of some of the new frames. Let's see. The presence of people with disabilities. Well, let me take that example first. That example led me to discover, wish I had Vasquez's book on bodies, but I didn't. And I found Paul Connerton's work. And Paul Connerton's work expanded on the work of Pierre Bourdieu and the notion of deep habituations. And as you know, Bourdieu's notion of habituations is about kinds of knowledges that we have that are pre-reflective. I mean, being able to play tennis is a kind of pre-reflective, deeply habituated skill and knowledge. Well, Connerton develops this notion in a book called How Societies Remember, and he's basically saying, he calls these practices incorporative practices. He's saying basically this body knowledge is part of a social of a cultural identity. So most of us want to talk about memory, cultural memory, as being a written memory, memory that what he's called practices of inscription. He says, there are three categories that go with cultural identity of bodily habituations. One is ritual. One is body technologies, which like hand language. And I can't think, he doesn't give really many examples of that. But the third one was bodily proprieties. His example is the Middle Ages. And this is about the way bodily performances, including dress, indicate status, class. His example is the peasants. You can tell a peasant by the way they dress and by the way they submit. I mean, their bodily postures. The king is going to have very different bodily proprieties, etc. So I use that category to develop the idea of racialized bodily proprieties and normate bodily proprieties. And the important point here, and Manuel makes this point as well, is that these have to be distinguished. We can't see bodies as simply expressing the meanings that we all share and we talk about in our written traditions. Bodies communicate in the performance. They can be at odds with what your practices of inscription are, but that distinction has to be protected. Bodies do their own communicating, and they're created and shaped by social. For Good Samaritan, this means their traditions weren't simply United Methodist or would other denominations shape them. Their traditions were not simply biblical or doctrinal. They were also racialized, normate, gendered, and other cultural habituations that operated as bodily incorporative practices. Theology is about bodies. Another example. So in other words, I go out and I get these new screens, frames for interpreting the place. The second one, if you've read the book, you're familiar with, and that is something to help me understand the people with disabilities. Because some of these people had language, but most of them didn't. And there was a spectrum of disabilities. So I sort of lived out what I came to critique, and that is these people were completely off my screen for the longest time. It was only about race. And after a while, I realized, well, you know, wait a minute. I can't exactly interview these people, so what am I going to do? I do need to take them seriously. And it was only later when I found some literature by educators that I discovered this notion of non-symbolic communication and the ways in which what had been understood even by medical folks who work with people with disabilities, that what was perceived to be disruptions and loud noises and so forth, the kind of things that keeps most churches from including people with disabilities, these were actually forms of communication, including bodily movements. So this was a new set of frames for me as well. In other words, ethnography did not result in it. It simply generated the need for new categories. A third example, let's see. How long am I supposed to go? How long do we go?
We go to 10, 15, 10, 20.
10:15. Oh, wow. Okay.
That's for Q&A.
Okay. Another example would be just the generation of the kind of thing that is synopsized as postmodern place theory. And I was trying to avoid a kind of, you know, not just a church versus world thinking, but also that theology doesn't typically offer the categories for the complex ways that faith is shaped by affect, physical realities, residuals, meaning the way the past is still a part of the present but not conscious. So I use postmodern place theory. Minimally, this allowed me to define a community as a place that sort of disrupts accounts of a context, either, you know, as a blank slate or simply to think in terms of the rational interpretive character of context. And so I read a variety of things that highlighted the affective, oral resonances of a variety of images to get at what now you could probably find if you did courses in religion and the visual, or religion around issues of music, the affective. So there are increasing ways for us to understand the way these variety of pieces of place shape what it is that means to live faithfully. Stanley Fish, I found very helpful to think about the way a particular community discerns, attends to, or notices a reality. His phrase, the stipulations of relevance, as a way to think about linking a community's beliefful knowing to a new problematic. What makes a community notice something? Stipulations of relevance, or are any number of possible dispositions in a communal repertoire that allow a developing situation, a wound, to appear significant. They also indicate that there are probably lots of situations and wounds that are being ignored. So that means you simply can't understand a faith world as simply a language world or as an insulated world. There's always an outside creating what being Christian or inside is. And this, of course, stipulations of relevance would be complicated. They're not all going to be shared by everyone. They're not going to simply be cognitive. They're going to entail affective associations, fears. And an example would be when I'm defining the unity of the place, I had identified three themes that continued. Welcome, the theme of welcome, the theme of conviction, and the theme of God dependence. But they had different associations for different groups of people, and et cetera, et cetera. So convictions are nested, which is to say they don't hold the same importance or matter equally at the same time. And surprise, surprise, they're multiple and conflicting and contradictory. So, challenges to standard theology. Issues that have surfaced challenges to theology. This is repeating, but the standard litmus for faith in congregations cannot be doctrinal orthodoxy, nor can it be articulated or reducible to articulated beliefs, nor can they be found to, as ordered in a consistent or logical way, nor do they necessarily have systematic connections. So, what does it mean to trace theological reasoning in a community? What genres might be helpful? And what are other significant challenges to definitions? We need a way to imagine the tracing of theological reasoning. And I'm not saying we need to do away with coherent thinking. Your Christology does need to have, or must have, or probably has some connection to your soteriology. Your notion of sin, your theological anthropology has some connection to your notion of redemption. So this just complicates that. The systematic character of theological reasoning, I'm going to skip some of this reference to the past. I've just started reading an old book, Dietrich Rischel's The Logic of Theology. One example of the fact that theologians have always had to have other images besides systematic or creedal. And there is a theologic that might be similar then to the valuational narrative I have employed. And, you know, if we want to discuss that, that'll be fine. But this also, this idea of a theological logic reasoning, a judgment that, and my theological logic was honoring finitely good creation, attending to its harm, working for its redress. That's a logic. That's what I mean by a logic. But there's sometimes forms of disconnect and other affective modes that shape us. And this simply is to say we need other genres. And we have other genres. And some of those genres have been named here already. One of the quickest one that comes to mind is narrative. Narrative is a very powerful genre that's an alternative to systematic thinking. We need genres to be about all sorts of things: survival, resilience, regret, relationships, resistance, mourning, etc. Now, narratives can be about those things, but also ways to recognize genres that are other than what we as theologians or highly cognitive thinkers would want to narrate. So, bodies, to conclude that. How are bodily communications theological genres? So finally, the work of the theologian. How is that implicit in an issue that needs addressing as we do ethnography and these expanding into other frames for reality? How might there be other approaches than texts about texts, which is a sort of perhaps an inadequate way to describe what theology has been, but many people will characterize theology as being texts about texts. There's this fascinating book by Wesley Court called Bound to Differ that is basically, he uses a kind of post-structuralist critique of theology as texts in relationship to text. You know, Bart doing so-and-so, and it's a fascinating book. I recommend it. But it is an exposure of this long-standing habit, and that some of the things stay out of our awareness when we're doing texts about texts. And that's critiqued by several of the authors in this book. But the question, the social location of theology as the production of knowledge. I wish there could be writing on the social location of theology writers. Now, there's this phrase, certifying discourse. I can't remember the official definition of it, but it has to. Certifying discourse is what gets credit socially for being the expert knowledge on something. So what I'm talking about is theology as certifying discourse. What makes it certifying discourse? You know, why is it that people in certain kinds of locations have the privilege of writing real theology? So that needs more fleshing out. I'm going to say some common sense stuff and close. The images that suggest knowledge production is not a social location are things like, what, ivory tower? What else? You heard any before? Academics is no place, right? And then let's get on the ground. Every time I hear that, I think, wait, we're on the ground when we're in our offices. That is a social location. And a lot of stuff is going on to sustain that. Material labor, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I'm not rejecting academic theology. I'm not. I need my job. There are other better reasons to keep it, too. I mean, the importance of discernment of general patterns over and above the specifics of ordinary life, I don't want to do away with that. I mean, I came up with these frames to think about, you know, racism as an academic because I could go read books and find frames that could be larger than the specifics of those situations. What I'm questioning is, and you already know this, the idea that contexts don't entail blindness, interest, and power dimensions that need attention. Academics is a context, and certifying discourse theology is produced by the what Barbara Ehrenreich used to call the professional managerial class. Sharon and Vegan have a deeply theological point related to this. The participation of theologians in other contexts, social locations that are strange in many ways, class, race, geographic, cultural, etc., they say that these are crucial for theologians' healthy development. Now, not only must we participate in other foreign contexts, we must be changed by this participation. With ethnographic work, not only are we not simply reporting what is out there, we are not simply bringing gifts to others. We are and need to be receiving from others, especially others who are not writers of books. This is not to say we shouldn't write books again, it's to demand a better balance between kinds of knowledges. Now, of course, there is a big danger in this. How to define this danger, and I hope you'll talk about that. How to avoid a kind of tourism. That's an important issue to discuss. Having experience of any sort is no guarantee of wisdom. And as it's already been pointed out, we make a book and we get some credit off of something that we're doing about these others that we're supposedly learning from. However, the failure to encounter, to explore and be challenged by realities that broaden our sense of the messy and risky and dangerous, horrific and wonderful elements of our world, that's not a good enough excuse, I think, to avoid protecting ourselves from tourism. Did that sentence make sense? Huh. I mean, there are dangers there. I don't think those dangers are enough to stop us from exploring that this ought to be something that's required for theological wisdom in some fashion. So I have a lot of remaining challenges. I've got a handout, but I'm going to stop right now. So for questions.
Questions? With theological wisdom, that is a game changer when you say that at the end, because you're not talking about analysis. Or, I mean, I guess it kind of, well, certainly ethnography as witness.
Mm-hmm.
And witness can cut both ways, mm-hmm. in that you're bearing witness to the witness that you discern.
Yeah.
The voice that you discern.
Yeah.
The summons, ethical summons, perhaps, that you receive or narrate in scholarship. Thinking this a quick, Charles, can you repeat what you said about narrative railroading or running over theory?
Something like a,
My first thought.
Runs over everything? Is that
runs over everything.
Runs over theory.
Oh, wow.
Runs over everything.
Uh-huh.
But my first thought on that was, why is that a problem?
Yeah.
And the only problem, and I was kind of joking, but the only problem that I think there is with that is you might not get funding for narrative. That if it's what, so we're all storytellers? I mean, that's what it is. And that brings to mind, I don't know if it was, who wrote the Jungle Book? Either Upton Sinclair or Sinclair Lewis. I get them confused. Okay, and I don't know which one of them said this, but the line was, it's hard to make someone understand something when their paycheck depends upon them not understanding. And I think that may be a helpful admonition in this lucrative storytelling work,
mm-hmm.
that at its best is a form of witness exchange.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I appreciate that, yeah.
Pete? I've got a sort of nuts and bolts question about methodology. I said last night, I really appreciate your book, and I actually kind of moved me. The book slowly moved me to tears of frustration. Not this one. There's one sort of startling moment in this, that I've been a participant, observer. chapter on being biblical interpretive practices,
mm-hmm.
you have these three different examples. One of the examples is a Bible study that you led, and I'm guessing, given that the Sunday school material was had subtitled A Woman's Vision of Women's Relationship in the Bible, that you brought that material to the
Yeah,
group.
Yeah.
Okay.
Emily, no, it wasn't. Sorry.
Anita,
yeah, yeah, okay. Anita Williams, sorry.
And then you come up, then in your sort of, in your conclusion of that chapter, you sort of hold this up as great stuff. My background in kind of documentary kind of field work, that strikes me as like putting the participant really strongly into the participant observing.
Yeah, yeah.
Thing. So could you say a little bit about your decisions to do that?
Yeah.
And then hold that up as so revealing. And then in a footnote to say, the impact of my whiteness and perceived status as an academic is more important, but harder for me to gauge. So my question to you is, could you please gauge that for us now?
I think what I haven't done...
It's on 169.
I don't think I've done an anywhere near adequate job of attending to the function of my social location. I can appeal to ignorance. Because what...
You don't strike me as an ignorant person. Can you have a shot at it now, of course?
Oh, you mean like what impact did my...
Yeah. Can you reflect on the fact that you brought
Right.
And then go, oh, isn't that interesting?
Let's see.
Because they would not have been reading that book.
Oh, right. Absolutely. The only way I could defend it is to say that their creative use of it was creative and not imposed by me. I mean, see, I had the prejudice of assuming they would really like Renita Williams. And some of them didn't. That was news, and that was a learning experience for me. One of them had been on welfare. She wasn't then, but I mean, this was a really unstable financially, a group that was unstable financially, and they didn't want to read about oppression. They wanted something hopeful. So that was them giving back to me. Now, did I create an artificial setting where that might emerge? Yes, but my expectations for what it would do were really wrong. So I don't know if I'm getting at what you're asking, what was the effect of my whiteness and my being the Duke person?
Yeah, the footnote strikes me as interesting. I mean, you're sort of covering your bases.
Oh, right.
But what was the impact of your whiteness and perceived status as an academic in that situation?
I want to turn that around and make that a question for everybody, because I'm not sure. I mean, I can guess. I did go to that church for a really long time. Relatively speaking, and it's hard for me to imagine that I was ever not perceived as the Duke person, okay? That's true. It was hard for me to gauge what the care was that was taken by them because after a while it sort of felt comfortable. I mean, you know, it didn't feel like people were acting weird around me. But that doesn't mean it didn't have an effect. So, anybody with some ideas? I mean, you all have done this.
It seems to me that part of the privilege is not having to ask, right? I mean, being the Duke person at the Methodist Church, it assumes a kind of privilege and a kind of authority that, you never had to ask.
Right. Thanks. That's well said. Yes. So they probably gave me some respect.
Probably.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, the Methodist Church is hierarchical, right? Clearly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bishops.
Authority,
right?
Yeah. Most of these people weren't Methodists, though.
And Duke is the richest Methodist institution.
True.
Probably.
True. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm imagining if I were in that situation, I would have to give some credentials.
Yes, yes. I think the incredible privilege was that I got all that I got. I mean, without having to push anybody. They folded this church into an historically African-American church, which I have continued to attend. So I've been at that church about 9 years, and I get a very different reaction from various folks in this church. And I mean, I'm not studying them, but I've had a lot of more honest experiences.
Can I ask you to say some more about what you're thinking? I mean, I'm just really curious about what's behind your question.
So I teach at UVA, and the project that I'm working on is born out of an experience that I had. My dad was from Charlottesville. Worked on the corner, as a pin setter. Couldn't have attended UVA, because, although he was a great student, because he was black. So for me to come back here, on my way to work this morning, I drove past my great-grandparents' farm. And I'm a fifth-generation United Methodist. I went to a Methodist church in Charlottesville, outside of Charlottesville, where I live. And I think of myself as someone who brings a number of gifts to my engagement with the church, a THD and MDiv. And I had a singularly horrible experience at this church. I'm singing in the choir. The district superintendent assumes that I'm being a paid soloist, because why else would I be here? I attend until Veterans Day, because their Veterans Day service is being held out at the Confederate Monument. So it gets better. This was November Veterans Day. The pastor, so I had AAR and a number of other things. I was going to be traveling, so I was going to be away for 2 or 3 weeks. The pastor met me at the door and said, "I heard you're leaving," because I couldn't participate in this. I just could not picture myself, my black self, in the choir robes. But and the thing about it was that I had joined the choir because the choir director knew one of my second cousins, who I'd never met. Methodists have been in Fluvanna County since 1790, and there is only one historically black Methodist church in all of the Charlottesville district. The pastor called me for the next 3 weeks while I was away, and never left a message, because she did not know what to say. Her theological education apparently had not, she felt, prepared her adequately to respond to a chagrined member of the congregation, right? So, all of the credentials that I thought I carried, Harvard degree, teachers at UVA, meant nothing. All they saw was black. Because that's all they saw, they had no experience with dealing with me in the context of Christian fellowship. And that is the state of the church. So I was able to come to UVA, which, owns slaves corporately, and become a functioning part of the faculty, and was not able to find a church in Charlottesville. The University of Virginia is better at integration than the church of Charlottesville, where people still have not acknowledged the fact that when Virginia schools, public schools closed rather than integrate, they were housed in local churches. And that is the state of reconciliation here. So that I ultimately have to live in those two worlds, those two realities. And I know that had I stepped into the church being described here, that I would have had an entirely different experience based on my black body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the problem of colorblindness is, well, as many have said, is the new form of racism. And
can I just make one little,
can I just make one quick comment here? Just thank you. That was, I've continued to encourage some kind of a memoir, ethnographic, theological work coming out of this narrative. I would like to make one recommendation that everyone read an extraordinary paper that Jenny McBride put together 6 or 7 years ago, precisely on the role of a very privileged Episcopal church in Charlottesville, Christ Episcopal Church, that served as the de facto Seg Academy in that year when the public schools closed, white public schools closed, so as not to have to integrate classrooms. It's a paper that Jenny did in 2002, 2003. It's on the website. It's also a paper that led to, as you might imagine, some very interesting conversations. basically got Jenny thrown out of church. She was never asked to present this paper in the church. I do have, though, it did have something to do with that reconciliation process that was attempted, I think, mm-hmm. in any case, between Trinity Episcopal mm-hmm. and Christ Episcopal. Mm-hmm. But I highly commend that work.
What's the title, Jim?
I think it's Christ Church Episcopal and its Massive Resistance.
It's on the theology.
It's on the what?
Lib Theology.
Oh.
And I'm sorry to be a shameless promoter, but John Keese, in that same period, was helping. We had a project in which we're trying to craft what we call the theological narrative of Charlottesville, which became very difficult because the privileged Charlottesvillians don't want to talk about anything. But this led to obviously also, when you're talking to African-American communities, a lot of the wounds point towards the Vinegar Hill relocation urban renewal project. And so John convened a gathering at Trinity Episcopal Church to discuss the book by Shackelford and I can't remember the other author's name, but the study of the Vinegar Hill Project in Charlottesville. They were both African American, both from Charlottesville. The book had been out almost 10 years and had never been invited back to Charlottesville or to the university to talk. And this was a standing room only event. It's online. It became a space where people who had been relocated could tell their stories. It also cast an embarrassing light on African-American middle class and business owners who were also complicit in this in a number of ways. Beautiful, extraordinary moments that really never connected to the congregations, precisely for the reason you described. And if you can make more sense of the pathology of the white churches in Charlottesville, or the church in Charlottesville, than I can, I'm really eager to hear your analysis.
Yeah. As I suggested, this was something I stumbled into, wasn't it? Please let me have a bad experience. Yeah. I stopped going to Methodist churches here in town. I'm a fifth generation United Methodist. My family in Baltimore did not leave the Methodist church. Mm-hmm. We were invited to join the AME church because they believed that there was some hope. But I went to a second Methodist church where the choir director would tell me racist things. You know it's racist when the white people standing by are going, "That's racist." And the choir director then subsequently follows me out to my car to tell me why it's not racist. I attended there until Easter. Easter, I was on my way up to the altar to sing, and he turned around to me and said, "Everybody but you, you know."
Oh.
Yeah.
I shouldn't be giving these shocked looks, but.
Charles keeps encouraging me to write this. It's like, oh my God. You know,
I'm trying to get tenure.
Yeah.
Well, a plug for the Polly Murray Project. this African-American church that they folded Good Shepherd into, I went to a number of years, and there were never any real conversations, but we've got a Pauli Murray reading group, and in this group, we all talk about our own family histories in relationship to Pauli Murray, and it's just, it's really different than anything I've experienced in church before. It really is.
I just want to point out a connection between what you said and Mary's work. You said that they could only see you as a black body in there, but then when it came to gathering at the Confederate memorial, they didn't see you as a black body, how that might have affected
That's
you.
Weird.
So you talk about that kind of two ways that blackness is, about how sometimes blackness just jumps out at people, and sometimes there's people are just oblivious.
Yeah. I bet when they imagine that scene, Valerie was not there.
That's yeah. right.
That's Valerie right. was not there. Yeah.
Because they still couldn't figure out how to integrate my experience at the opposite right. of the Confederacy mm-hmm. as a part of that congregation. And the pastor couldn't think what to say to me. So I continue to get like phone calls from people like in December and January. Gee, where are you? Mm-hmm. You know, why aren't you, you know, what's going on? Where the choir director did not know what to say and just said, call Valerie. You know, I mean, Confederate monument. Okay, so, I mean, the pastor didn't want to offend the guy that was organizing this thing, who's a major giver, and he liked the Confederates.
I would also just like to humbly point out that I think this all ties into what Manuel was talking about earlier about, you know, theology of carnality, mm-hmm. and to say that, you know, I don't know if any of you ever, you know, have realized this, but there's also, in church, there tends to be a scripting of our bodies, mm-hmm. especially if you're female, mm-hmm. and it's always the curvaceous minority
right.
women that are told, you know, you're distracting your
right, 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 right.
And how? And I think people just say this very, like, honestly. I'm sure you'd like to help your brothers in Christ, like, please wear a long dress,
right.
you know. But how does that?
Right.
They never think. How does that make that woman feel?
Right.
To say your body is not holy, or
right.
what is okay on that
right.
woman is not okay on you.
Right.
You know, and I
right.
think that these things are just not
right.
not thought about from a normative.
And they're not, yeah, they're not considered central theological issues. And that's another sort of missing piece in the book, is that when I finally came up with Connerton's categories, the church had already folded into another church. I couldn't go back. And what, you know, obviously gender would have been a really fascinating thing to use, to look at the bodily proprieties around gender. But since I didn't get to explore that, but it's absolutely relevant. I gave a homily at this conference at University of Dayton last week, and I had an interesting reaction from some people who I shouldn't describe, but they came up to me and they said, they'd never seen a woman preach before. And it was like, I was wondering if I was invading sacred space. But, you know, the body thing is always already shaping what's the perceptions, whether it's named or not, so... other questions?
And we have about 5 minutes. Chris, sorry.
I have a question. Just another sort of methodological question. Using sort of the theme of image of place here and the near places of appearance, whatever. So I was wondering, in the process, did that theme sort of evolve as you were in sort of the ethnographic, you know, process, and if so, sort of how and when? Or did you enter into the, you know, into this thinking that you wanted to do sort of ecclesiological work along the lines of place, and you know, the first part of place theory and all that?
Mm-hmm.
And sort of a second question would be, you know, using sort of the spatial imagery of, you know, place and embodiment and that kind of stuff, do you offer some, you know, sort of alternative spatial images for the church? And you don't connect them to sort of traditional spatial images
mm-hmm.
for the church, and it seems like that's
mm-hmm.
an intention. Maybe some reasons why you do that. I was wondering if you could also talk more about that decision.
Say some more about alternative images for
well,
church
space. Places of appearing and
mm-hmm.
sort of in the embodiment images and all, you talk about that, but you don't necessarily relate it to, you know, sort of traditional images of, you know, body of Christ necessarily, except some towards the end or,
oh,
you know,
yeah.
the church as a temple, other sort of ecclesiological
images.
You don't make that connection. So it seems like that was an intentional thing to do, which I can, you know, maybe come up with some reasons why, just from what you said, why you would do that. I was wondering if you could help me.
Yeah. Well, I think expanding it and connecting it to a theology of the body of Christ would have been a really constructive thing to do. I mean, I think I just sort of ran out of time and ran out of pages, and sort of that theological anthropology was sort of my primary loci or locus. And one of the questions I had in this handout was, you know, to sort of pursue whether the adequacy of the particular reading that I did on sin as rooted in idolatry and the way it looks, is typical for me as to the way I would have approached eventually describing body of Christ. But any constructive additional images, I would appreciate. One of the paradoxes for body of Christ is this sort of. I haven't connected the theological anthropology enough, I think, to the ambiguities of these different modes of experience.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. And you talk about the marked body of Christ towards the end, and I was thinking, well, that's not a really sort of appropriate image that, you know, could have maybe been useful, but I thought maybe you had some sort of intentional.
Undeveloped.
Foregrounding situation over tradition.
Right.
So you're sort of avoiding some of those to just offer sort of less standing on sort of new ecclesiological.
Right.
And then also the place thing, did that sort of evolve in the ethnographic process, or was that, did you come in sort of with that?
I found it later.
Okay.
And that's an issue back to the methodology and the adequacy of an ethnographic approach is with the use of these theories, I've moved way beyond what, you know, the participants in that community could have or were given option of okaying or not. There are forms of ethnographic work that require the participants, the interviewees, to have feedback in terms of what gets written. And I had an event where I told them what I was going to be writing and got some feedback, but it wasn't of the final project. And the church had basically disappeared. Very few people ended up going to this other church. So by the time I actually came up with the theory, the framing, the new framing, there wasn't really anybody around. And I doubt if they would have wanted to read that book. Now, is that, you know, that's a methodological issue, and, you know, glad to have people discuss that at further length. I used real people, and I developed frames that certainly were not their choice. So is that, even though, you know, I mean, your book is lots of frames, but it doesn't include any real people, so is it okay to do it that way, but not okay to put these two things together when you don't have the permission of the people who are being described as, living out of ownership of space and so forth. So,
thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you.